Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the Senate Committee on Health Care. It's Thursday, February 16th, and we're going to change the agenda. We're going to do Senate Bill 215 first, and then Senate Bill 561 second, and then 52 and 56. So with that, I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 215. Oliver.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, before you, Senate Bill 215, the measure requires the Oregon Health Authority to establish, operate, and evaluate a database that collects information on the treatment of rare diseases. The measure specifies an initial set of rules to govern access to and the use of database, including data confidentiality and authorized users, requires OHA to establish an advisory committee to oversee the database and its use. There are no amendments and testimonies available on OLIS.
Great. All right. Thank you. Let's call up let's call up Tim Boyd, Jennifer Knapp, and Sandy Puckett first.
Chairwoman Mattis Anderson and members of the Health Care Committee, thanks for the opportunity to speak with you today. I'm here to testify in support of Senate Bill 215, which will set up a rare database called ORDER for Rare Disease Emergency Response. It will provide a valuable tool for healthcare providers so that they can do what they do best, save lives. I'm here today to speak on behalf of my daughter, who has a rare disease, as the director of Adrenal Insufficiency United, and as the state ambassador for the National Organization for Rare Disorders. Senate Bill 215 has evolved from a bill in 2015 to help those with adrenal insufficiency to include all with rare disease. In fact, this bill could impact 1 in 10 Oregonians, the estimated number affected by rare disease. So this slide just talks about why do we need this bill. There are over 7,000 rare diseases identified, and the numbers continue to grow. Many with rare disease require specialized care. And when unexpected emergencies occur, it is vital that healthcare providers have accurate information to treat the patient. Enabling healthcare providers to access this information quickly will improve outcomes and save lives. The vision for ORDER is that a private practice healthcare provider would be able to access the data and upload orders for their patient. And hospitals and urgent care centers, information on the patient will be available on the internet. In the field, EMTs would be able to call medical control to access information in order to act on the order from the physicians. School nurses and or police officers would also be able to utilize the system as well when relevant. We did a survey of about 78 patients representing 18 different rare disease disorders. And these are just some of the things that came out with it. 90% indicated their rare disease or disorder required specialized treatment. 88% said that they have experienced a delay in treatment or improper treatment. Some of the other big things, 80% of patients indicated they suffered longer than necessary. 9% of the patients suffered permanent damage. One of the 78 passed away. And the 82% was medical staff were not familiar with their rare disease was the reason for the delay or the improper treatment. So ORDER would provide a valuable tool for healthcare providers. Patients will have fewer complications and better overall outcomes during unexpected emergencies. Better outcomes is less money spent on hospital stays and our follow-up care. So please vote yes on Senate Bill 215.
Thank you very much.
Hi, I'm Sandy Puckett, and I'm a bleeding disorder nurse educator. I've been a pediatric nurse for 30 years, and I worked at Dornbecker Children's Hospital for 17 of those years at the Child Development and Rehabilitation Center for many years, and was the nurse coordinator for the state of Oregon at the Oregon Hemophilia Treatment Center. And I'm here to speak just regarding the rare disorder of hemophilia, which affects 1 to 5,000 to 7,000 live male births, where the body does not make the sufficient proteins necessary to make a stable clot. And these patients, particularly with severe hemophilia, are at a disadvantage of being able to arrest the bleeding. And the MASAC, the Medical and Scientific Advisory Council, which is basically kind of a think tank of the highest grade clinicians in the nation, have come out with a document through the National Hemophilia Foundation, document 175, which clearly recommends that individuals with bleeding disorders who present have rapid access to the medication necessary to arrest the bleeding. Intracranial hemorrhage is the highest risk issue, and the recommendation is that these patients, even if they suspect that they have a bleeding issue, administer that medication within 1 hour, if humanly possible. And so to have something like this available that permits people in the field or in traumatic events to be able to have access to that information, those orders, these people are seen at highly specialized treatment centers. The Hemophilia Treatment Center here is at OHSU, and they are instructed very clearly on their disease and disease management. And so they have this medication readily available to them in their homes. They take it with them traveling, and in the event of a traumatic event, that rapid access is paramount for them to reduce the morbidity and mortality regarding that. And really the motto is, if in doubt, infuse. And if there's really no downside to that, it's just that lack of access can impact patient health outcomes, certainly, not to mention that the costs regarding managing these patients after they have sustained a bleeding event of such significance can certainly occupy a hospital bed that is necessary for other folks and drive healthcare costs up exponentially, caring for these people that have now incurred irreparable harm. And so just that factor, replacement therapy and instructions and access to order can really help mitigate the long-term effects, rapid access to treatment, and really help improve quality of life and while reducing overarching healthcare costs, which is certainly something that needs to be addressed as well in the current economic complexion of medicine. So that's about all I know about that.
Thank you. I'm Tim Boyd, Associate Director of State Policy for the National Organization for Rare Disorders. NORD is a leading voice in the rare disease community dedicated to helping people with rare diseases and assisting organizations that serve them. One of our member organizations is the Springfield-based Adrenal Insufficiency United, whose executive director, Jennifer Knapp, is also serving as a volunteer state ambassador for Oregon. Any disease affecting fewer than 200,000 Americans is considered rare. Currently, there are about 7,000 of these diseases identified, affecting roughly 30 million Americans. These disorders require highly specialized care that can include complex medical directives. This makes it nearly impossible for emergency medical personnel, even with their expert training, to provide appropriate treatment to a person with a disorder they may have never encountered before or likely even heard of. By creating an electronic database for rare disease patient treatment protocols, the orders bill will provide medical teams timely access to patient information that will improve medical outcomes and save lives. Specifically, orders will benefit EMS personnel and rare disease patients in two main ways. First, it will prevent inappropriate treatment from being administered because responders misdiagnose or misunderstand rare disease symptoms. And second, orders will provide clear instructions for when rare disease patients need to be treated with specialized medicines to avoid a worsening of their medical condition, such as hemophilia factor. This legislation also provides flexibility to the Oregon Health Authority to ensure orders are not implemented without patient consent or in a manner that impedes the work of emergency personnel. What's more, it established an expert committee appointed by the Oregon Health Authority to ensure proper development and rollout of the orders system. With committee support, orders will provide a vital new tool to ensure better care for rare disease patients in Oregon, and we strongly encourage you to support it. Thank you.
Wonderful. Short, concise, and to the point. All right, thank you very much. Any questions for this panel? Not at this time? Okay.
Thank you.
With that, I'd like to call up, is it Brittany Ruiz, Stacy Black, and Mary Adoinis? And let's have Brittany go first.
Thank you so much.
You have a birthday party. No. That's the next bill. Okay.
I did last week.
Okay.
Come over here.
My name is Brittany Ruiz, and I'm a parental rights activist. I saw Senate Bill 215, and when I read it, my concerns are it's well-intentioned. It's a well-intentioned bill. I have no complaints with what it's for. My sister has Lyme's disease. My brother has Asperger's. So I do understand the general scope of what it is, but the problem with the bill is it's too broad, it's too general. Specifically, no specifics on what diseases we're talking about in the bill. It needs to be laid out what are rare diseases. And also, who's going to have access to these? Like, who are going to be, how is it going to be controlled? I mean, for example, OHSU just settled a huge violation, a HIPAA violation of over $2.7 million because a doctor brought a computer on vacation and someone stole it. And it had thousands and thousands of vital records on there that they stole off of that computer, including Social Security numbers, information about the people. So my concern is we're now doing a whole new database, which is already available at federal level for rare diseases, but it's not specified. Oregon also has a higher epidemic of autism, of disabilities than we do have on rare disabilities, and I don't see any real emphasis of this bill to even address that side. And I currently have friends whose kids are getting kicked out of school because of autism, because they can't handle them. So I'd like to see a little bit more understanding of what's a rare disease. I'd like to be more specific, because I see that no one's being malicious here. No one's being badly intentioned on this bill. I just think it needs to be very specific what it's supposed to achieve and what rare diseases it's going to cover. That's all I have to say.
Thank you very much for coming. And I know you have to leave.
Yes, thank you. Oh, and I oppose SB 215 as it's written.
Okay.
Hello, my name is Stacey Black, and I, too, oppose SB 215 as it's written. Some of the main concerns I have also is that it's vague and that it's I'd like it to be an opt-in as opposed to an opt-out database. And I, too, think it's a duplication of several national databases. So I'm curious about why Oregon would have such a limited scope of just Oregon information when we have NIH, CDC, PubMed, and numerous other rare disease databases. And I also have a letter here from Dr. Paul Thomas, a board-certified pediatrician, to over 13,000 patients in the Portland, Oregon area. While written to sound like it will benefit those poor patients who have rare diseases by having standing orders that doctors and emergency workers, first responders, and the like could use to administer pharmaceutical products and guide the care for these patients, in reality, this bill is nothing of the sort. If I have a severe peanut allergy, I wear an alert bracelet. If I have hemophilia that requires I get factor infusion before procedures, if there are medical approaches needed for my rare condition, I find ways to make that known in all situations. I would not want to rely on passive orders from the Oregon Health Authority process. As a physician, if I'm caring for a patient with a rare disorder, I do my research. I seriously doubt this bill intends to replace the NIH, CDC, and all the other societies for rare disorders, and through PubMed research from whom I get information as a physician. We would be creating an inferior resource, wasting taxpayers' money to do so, and to top it off, the orders are secret. The entity cannot be subpoenaed, and everyone involved is free from liability. This bill must be stopped now, or at least rewritten. This clearly is a power grab by pharma, and I can see it ripe for misuse. Each year, we hear the epidemic flu warnings and ads on TV to get your flu shot, and public health officials urging everyone to get the flu shot, while by the CDC data, we learn that years of flu shots was 20 or 40% effective. This bill would be used to mandate or order flu shots. We all remember the measles epidemic in Disneyland 2014. One man in his 40s returned from Disneyland to Oregon with the measles. You can be certain there would be orders that every Oregonian had an MMR shot. Do you recall how many of the Oregonians got the measles from that man? None. How many died in the U.S. as a result of that Disneyland epidemic? None. How many died past decades? None. How many caught the measles and actually had vaccine-strained measles? Unknown. It was either never reported or never tested. We have a public health system that has become a marketing and distribution arm of pharma. I was a lifelong Democrat and proud of the tradition of looking out for the weak, undeserved, the poor, and those without a voice. Democrats seem to have sold out to pharma, some Republicans too. The huge surprise of the national election had plenty to do with this very issue. This bill is a perfect example of pharma-funded power grabbing misuse of our government. I urge each and every one of you to stop this misguided bill right here and right now. Say no to pharma-driven bills that had nothing to do with protecting us and only puts us all in harm's way. Thank you for your attention. Dr. Paul Thomas, MD.
Hi, I'm Mary Eleonis from Southern Oregon. I'm a farmer. I am opposed to Senate Bill 215 as it is written. I'm also concerned that the language of this bill is too vague and can later be tweaked to infringe on the medical freedoms of Oregonians. It proposes a database that is redundant, as there are already lists of identifiable rare diseases that are reportable. My concern is that each individual's right to bodily freedom and informed consent, even those with rare diseases, perhaps requires the right to refusal of medical treatment, and that is potentially in jeopardy with this bill as it is written. I would like to voice my concerns about those and would hope that this bill could be written in a way that is less vague.
Thank you so much for coming. Questions for this panel?
Madam Chair, would it be possible for me to ask a question of the proponents now that I've heard the testimony in opposition?
Yes, let's go through that, and
sure,
then we'll bring them
back.
That's
fine. Thank
okay.
you very much.
All right, thank you very much. And let us bring up Christy Deeds and Art Towers. And Christy,
right.
you
okay.
go first.
I want to be really honest. I didn't know I was actually speaking today, and this is my first time ever attending. So I would like to speak on behalf of my nephew.
Your name first.
Oh, I'm sorry. My name is Christy Deeds. And I would like to speak on behalf of my nephew, Patterson, who has epidermolysis bullosa, which is a genetic connective tissue disorder. So he's born without the proteins that bind his skin together. In relation to this bill, I do feel like it's an incredibly positive benefit because Patterson may not need an antibiotic or a pill or medication, but for an emergency medical responder to realize that his skin will literally fall off or his hand could completely deglove based on the materials they're using is incredibly important for them to know. Because wound care is the only treatment that anybody living with EB has provided to them. So it is important to know that latex gloves may not be appropriate or that the tape they're going to use on him will pull the skin off of his leg. So I am in agreement with the bill.
Great. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Arthur Towers with the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association, and I'm going to set aside whether or not to go forward with the bill, but if you do decide to go forward, we have concerns about Section 7 in particular. One of the earlier witnesses testified about the data breaches that could occur, and Section 7 seems to provide immunity for everybody involved if such a data breach could occur, and so I just wanted to flag that for the committee. Also, and I'm a little bit less clear on Section 6 about the confidentiality of the information. Clearly, you know, the information, the personally identifiable information should be confidential in keeping with HIPAA. But one of our folks looked at it and thought that confidentiality language might be a little bit overbroad in terms of there might be some uses for the aggregate data, for example. So, but Section 7 is really the piece I wanted to flag for the committee. So, with that, I'm happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Great. Questions for this panel? Okay. would Jennifer Knapp and Pop, and would it be Tim? To answer some questions now that you've heard both sides here.
Yeah.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So how closely is this legislation modeled on Oregon's existing physician order for life-sustaining treatment registry?
Yes, thank you for that question, Senator Steinberg and Senator Monis Anderson. It is directly...
Reintroduce yourself.
I'm sorry. This is Jennifer Knapp with Adrenal Insufficiency United and National Organization for Rare Disorders. Actually, the bill was written as pulsed as the basis for it. I actually looked at the Pulse bill that had passed and just cut and pasted to make it say this bill. So it's based a lot on that. That's where I got the idea from, was from Pulse. I talked to people in the Pulse system, and they indicated that since Pulse was physician's orders for life-sustaining treatment, that this really didn't fit. I asked, you know, could it be a sister leg of Pulse, and they weren't sure about that, and so that's really where the idea came from. And the database would not be a general database. It would be the specific orders for that specific patient would be what is set up with the database. So if the physician looks up my daughter's medical alert bracelet and it shows her number, however her identifier is, it would be the orders from her specific physician that they would be looking at, not just kind of a general database.
Follow up, if I may, Madam Chair. Thank you. That's really helpful. So... one of the questions then becomes, you know, with the Pulse database, people have to opt in to completing a Pulse form, and it has to be part of a conversation with their primary care provider, right, or whichever doctor is managing or physician assistant or whatever is managing their health care. They have to opt in that regard. And then they can actually – they have to opt into writing the Pulse, but then they can opt out of being in the registry, right? Mm-hmm. So – is it your understanding that people would have to have that similar conversation with their doctors about whether their orders would be entered in, or is it would there have to be some conversation? Because it's a little hard for me to understand at this point how the opt-out would work. As a physician, I'd have trouble going ahead and putting in orders for a patient without telling them that I was doing it. So I'm not quite sure where that so, how that quite works.
Yeah, thank you. So my vision for this was that it would be totally a conversation between a healthcare provider and their patient, that they would opt in to being in the database, that it would not be required at all.
Okay.
So that was the intent of it.
Okay. And one more really quick question. So when you, in your conversation, I mean, I'm not a big believer in reinventing the wheel, and I think, and I'm certainly not a big believer in spending lots of money that doesn't have to be spent. The Pulse registry is working really well. Is there any reason we couldn't use them? Did you get the impression from them that they would be unwilling to take on the additional load for this one? We would have to create an entirely separate system, because I think it would be tough for our paramedics to have to call two different numbers for two different sets of things. And I don't want this to be a pattern where we develop a new registry.
Mm-hmm. It would be wonderful if there was already a system in place that we could not reinvent the wheel and just use that system that's already there. Some people at Pulse seemed more open to it than others, and I don't remember their names. I've talked to two or three different people. So some thought maybe it could, and some said no.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. Thank you very much. And so I would like the proponents of the bill to... you know, it needs some cleaning up, and I think that maybe working with the Oregon Health Authority or the Pulse people to sort of get some consensus on making this bill maybe ready to go. It's not ready to go now. All right? All right. Thank you. I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 215, and I will open a public hearing on 561.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 561 is brought to you by Senator Girard. The measure permits students of dentistry and dental hygiene to perform under indirect supervision at OHSU dental faculty in specific community-based or clinical settings in Oregon. Declares emergency effective on passage. There is a dash one amendment. The amendment deletes the word direct and replaces it with indirect when referencing supervision by OHSU faculty. There is testimony available on OLIS.
Philip Maruka, Dan, is it Saucy? And Lynn Ironside.
Good Good afternoon, Madam Chair and Senators. My name is Phil Maruca, and I'm the Dean of the School of OHSU School of Dentistry. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today in support of Senate Bill 561, which will change state law to conform to the best practices at schools of dentistry around the country and endorsed by the American Dental Association and supported by the Oregon Dental Association and done in, also in context with the Oregon Board of Dentistry. As you are aware, state law currently states that students performing dental procedures be directly supervised by dental school faculty. This strongly implies a one-to-one faculty to student ratio, which, if strictly enforced, would severely limit OHSU's ability to train new dentists and dramatically increase the cost to the students. As with other health professions, an essential component of providing high-quality dental education is providing opportunities for students to perform clinical care supervised in a manner appropriate to their level of experience, the extent of knowledge, complexity of the procedure, and safety of the patient. That is exactly what we do at the OHSU School of Dentistry. Our level of supervision follows the American Dental Association's Commission on Dental Accreditation Guidelines of ensuring the level of supervision is appropriate for patient safety and student education. More specifically, in the OHSU pre-doctoral program, students provide direct patient care from their first year of dental school through graduation. OHSU's postgraduate programs involve students being trained in specialty areas of dentistry and providing care for patients in expanded levels of complexity. To ensure patient safety at OHSU, the ratio of supervising faculty to learning students depends on the specific treatment circumstances and our faculty's judgment regarding the complexity of the specific procedure, the experience and competence of the student, and the particular condition of the patient. OHSU's faculty make these determinations on a day-to-day, student-to-student, procedure-to-procedure basis. Therefore, supervision in some circumstances is direct faculty-to-student supervision. At other times, a number of students may be working with patients and being supervised by one faculty member close by within the clinic. This is an indirect supervision, and it is the standard of practice at all schools of dentistry across the United States. In reviewing the bill, I noticed we had missed two additional references to direct supervision, and I asked our staff to develop an amendment, Amendment 1. I sincerely appreciate the legislature's consideration of this change and of the support you continue to show for all the health disciplines at OHSU. And thank you again for the opportunity to testify, and I'd be happy to answer any questions for you. I in fact, support also the part that relates to dental hygiene. So,
let's go through the panel, and then we'll have questions.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm Dr. Dan Soce. I'm a dentist here in Salem for 36 years, and I graduated from the Oregon Dental School in 1981. The name change was going on at the time, so it was, anyway, it's Oregon Health and Science University. And thank you for allowing me to opt to testify regarding this Senate Bill 561. One of the things, I'm also on the Oregon Health Authority workforce, and one of the opportunities this facilitates is allow our experienced students to go out into the hinterlands and work in clinics, and especially underserved areas. This has been one of the focuses of the Oregon Health Authority's workforce for the last couple of years, as Oliver will maybe testify or affirm, that this gives a chance for students to get out into the country, learn about it, and hopefully they'll stay there. So, or be inspired to work in these underserved areas. I've personally operated in 13 different dental schools, from Jackson, Mississippi, to Morgantown, West Virginia, Meharry, UCLA. Never have I seen a one-to-one correlation between the instructor and there's really no need for that. It's just you're across the room. So I urge you to support this change in the wording. And I also want to say that we want to the Oregon. I represent the Oregon Dental Association, and we support the dental hygiene aspect of this as well.
Wonderful.
Any questions?
Let's go to Lynn, and then we'll open it up for questions.
Chair Mona Sanderson, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Lynn Ironside. I'm a registered dental hygienist, and I reside in Portland, Oregon. I'm a member of the Oregon Dental Hygienist Association, and I'm representing ODHA today as their lobbyist. The ODHA supports Senate Bill 561 and thanks OHSU for including dental hygiene education in this proposed legislation. Senate Bill 561 would change the supervision requirement for dental and dental hygiene students engaged in clinical studies from direct supervision to indirect. Dental hygiene students engage in clinical studies as part of their education in order to attain clinical competence and develop clinical judgment. All patient care provided by dental hygiene students is supervised by faculty members. Level of supervision provided by faculty members is based on the student's level of skill, the procedure that's being performed, and the needs of the patient. Direct supervision, as it appears in the current statute, implies that the faculty to student ratio for clinical studies must be 1-to-1, which would mean one faculty member per student during clinical studies. The American Dental Association's Commission on Dental Accreditation Standards for Dental Hygiene Education state that faculty to student ratios must be sufficient to ensure the development of competence and ensure the health and safety of the public. During dental hygiene clinical studies, CODA specifies that the faculty to student ratio must not exceed 1-to-5. Indirect supervision, as it is proposed in this bill, would allow faculty members to provide the level of supervision that's appropriate based on the student's level of skill, procedure being performed, and the needs of the patient. Indirect supervision would not preclude a faculty member from providing direct supervision appropriate, but it would not require a faculty member to provide direct supervision when it's not appropriate. Indirect supervision is in alignment with the accreditation requirement that faculty to student ratios must be sufficient to ensure the development of competence and ensure the health and safety of the public. In closing, the Oregon Dental Hygienist Association supports Senate Bill 561 because it will allow faculty members to continue to provide the level of supervision appropriate for the dental or dental hygiene student's level of skill, the procedure that is being performed, and the needs of the patient. Thank you for the opportunity to testify before you today, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Great. Question?
Yes. Let me just quick comment.
Yeah.
This is what they're proposing here is exactly how we do it in medicine. We do not require one-on-one, full-time direct supervision, and there's no reason in the world that we should be requiring it for dentists and dental hygienists in training either. This is a perfectly reasonable bill.
Other questions? So we will wait for your amendments, and then when we get your amendments, we can post it for work session. We probably wouldn't have another public hearing because there's no opposition to the bill. Okay.
Thanks for your time and your service to Oregonians.
You bet.
Thank you.
All right. With that, I close the public hearing on Senate Bill 561 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 52.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, before you, Senate Bill 52, brought to you by the Oregon Health Authority. The measure directs the Oregon Health Authority to adopt rules for ambulance service and emergency medical service providers report patient encounter data to an EMS data management system for individual patient care events. The bill specifies the types of patient outcome data required for reporting to the Oregon Trauma Registry. The bill also requires data entered by hospitals into the Oregon Trauma Registry to be available to EMS providers who transport a patient. The bill would also direct OHA to determine by rulemaking the method for which data are available and how the data may be used, removes the ability of hospitals to charge a fee for reporting information to the Trauma Registry.
Great. So Nanheim, Sean Baird, and Ritu Sani. I assume you want to go first, correct?
Whatever your pleasure, ma'am.
Okay. I don't know.
Go. You want Nan? Chair Mona Sanderson, Vice Chair Cruz, and members of the committee. I'm Nan Heim, and I'm here today on behalf of the Oregon State Ambulance Association. Our members are public agencies like Bend Fire and Eugene Springfield Fire, private companies like AMR and Cal-Or that serve ambulance service areas that are assigned to them by their counties, providing emergency transportation, ambulance transportation. Over the years, our members have often talked about data, expressing a wish that they had more of it on a statewide basis because they feel it would be so helpful. So when this bill came up, we discussed it in detail at a couple of meetings. We did have some concerns, primarily about how smaller rural agencies would be able to do this. Our president, Sean Baird, and I met with Dr. Dana Sulliver at the Oregon Health Authority to air our concerns, and she took some steps to address them. And I'm going to have Sean explain what her concerns were and how they've been addressed. Thank you.
Great. Chair Mona Sanderson and members of the committee, my name is Sean Baird. I'm the owner of Woodburn Ambulance Service and the president of the Oregon State Ambulance Association. As Nan said, we really support the goal of meaningful data collection and believe that we can get there with Senate Bill 52. The issues that we kind of needed to work through involved whether very small to medium-sized agencies logistically could comply and would be able to meet the goals. We also were concerned about some problems of a technical nature with whether our software would be compatible, just really IT-oriented things, which when we've tried voluntarily submitting into the current database, we've experienced a few problems with that. But Dr. Sulliver, recognizing that and assured us that the timeline for implementation wouldn't be until 2019 at the earliest, giving some time to work together to figure out how to overcome some of those barriers. And we're quite comfortable with that. We also wanted to make sure that if a requirement for data to go into a system was there, that there be a requirement for data to come back out in a useful format for the providers. And we discussed that again with the health authority, and we'll be working on an amendment actually that would talk about how to facilitate reporting that that we think would work well for everyone in consultation. The health authority would be in consultation with the state EMS advisory committee to set benchmarks for what data and how the reporting would look coming out of it. So we feel pretty good about that. And finally, I guess I would just end on that we think this is really a step toward an ultimate goal of linking some hospital outcome data with some of the pre-hospital data so that we could really drive the quality discussions that need to take place around, you know, how do we deploy our resources? What interventions are we using? And are they resulting in the outcomes we're looking for? So all that said, that's probably the real solution.
Wonderful.
Thanks, Sean. Chair Mona Sanderson and members of the committee, my name is Dr. Ritu Sawhney. I am here representing the National Association of EMS Physicians, the Oregon chapter. NEMSP is an organization of physicians and other professionals partnering to provide leadership and foster excellence in the subspecialty of EMS medicine. I would say that our group primarily represents the medical direction or medical oversight of our EMS care, although we do have non-physician members also. In a past life, I also served as the state's EMS and trauma medical director and certainly remember many attempts to get this data moving in a positive and forward manner. We are supportive of Senate Bill 52. As EMS medical directors, we prefer that all of our decisions around protocols and patient care are data-driven. And there are two types of data that we look for. One is the latest research and recommendations and guidelines about pre-hospital emergency care. But the other data that we look for is our own local outcomes. So what we feel has always been important about having a statewide database is being able to pull back in our breakdown of patient care, whether it's call type, call variety, and then ultimately looking at how our treatment affects the ultimate patient outcome. And so one of the things that's very beneficial to this bill and that Sean also addressed is the idea that it would require us to get the patient outcomes back from the hospital. And we feel that this is one of the key strengths of the bill and something that we support very strongly. As we look at our EMS system as a whole, we're still mired in a place where we measure the system based on things like how long it takes to get to the patient. And we really need to start measuring the system based on how our patients do ultimately. And this would be a key step to moving in that direction statewide and policy-wide. Thank you.
Questions for this panel?
Okay. Could I just clarify for the Oregon State Ambulance Association that we do support Senate Bill 52. I think I really didn't make that clear.
That's right. And it looks like we'll be working. Now let's call the Oregon Health Authority, Dana Selover. And it's your bill.
Chair Monis Anderson, Vice Chair Cruz, members of the committee, yes, it is our bill, and thank you very much. I'm here today, again, for the record. My name is Dana Selover. I am the state director of EMS and Trauma Systems, but also the section manager for healthcare regulation and quality improvement that regulates other parts of the health care facility. So I have a stake in this in both areas. I'm here today to ask for your support for Senate Bill 52. It's been a long time coming, as you heard, and we'd like to see licensed ambulance agencies report electronically patient care records to a state database. Our section, as I said, has oversight over the EMS and the EMS providers, trauma hospitals, ambulance agencies, in addition to healthcare facilities writ large. We are also responsible, among other things, for creating a statewide EMS pre-hospital system of data. And it's really important to have that accurate and comprehensive and reliable data in order to make improvements to the EMS and trauma systems. And our section has been working very diligently. Actually, public health has worked very diligently since 2012 to set up this voluntary reporting system that you heard about as a bit of a proof of concept. And we've been pretty successful. In 2016 alone, we had 334,000 EMS patient care records from 66% of the 132 licensed ambulance agencies. And we'd really like to see this formalized. We'd like to see Senate Bill 52 passed and formalize the reporting and make it mandatory. There are a couple advantages to that. And we'd also like to see it enable healthcare information exchange between the pre-hospital care realm and other parts of the healthcare system, including, of course, coordinated care organizations who will be interested in this data. So we'd like to see that happen. Based on the feedback that you heard, we have made a couple of changes. One important thing I wanted to make is that this bill was not intended to require individual EMS providers to report this data. That was a late-breaking legislative council miscommunication, and so we'd like to see that stricken. But we'll work with the stakeholders to get those other amendments included. So only licensed ambulance agencies at this point. And I will thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Well, I know that we have sent in, there's been a request for an amendment starting in 2020. OHA will issue an annual report in consultation with the State Emergency Medical Services Committee on the data collected from ambulance services under the Section 1 of this Act. So that's one request that I'd like you to make sure that you work on, as well as sort of a phase in time. I mean, for those entities that do not have electronic records, I would hope that there would be some accommodation. I remember as a nurse in the 90s working for Clackamas County, and no one wanted to do computers. And it took several years to get our CDC nurses to be able to use a computer. So I really see that there needs to be some accommodation for those entities that don't have computers. So those two things.
Yeah.
Madam Chair? Yes. Thank you. Really supportive of this, Ms. Sullivan, and completely agree that the data will be very, very useful. I have had the opportunity to do research based on data from the State Cancer Registry, and one of the problems there is the inconsistency in reporting from different hospitals. And I wonder what your thoughts are about how to train people and ensure that we're not getting to a place where it's kind of garbage in, garbage out, and we actually have usable data, especially around the long term. You know, you admit a level one trauma patient from the field, and they're maybe in the hospital for a month, and then who's going to remember that you need to put discharge information into the system? How's that going to work, and how are you going to ensure the quality? I mean, I think that some of that's going to come out in the rulemaking, but I just want to at least put that on the record as a concern.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, Senator Steiner-Hayward, member of the committee. That's a really good point, and this system that we've had in place, the voluntary reporting system, is based on national EMS information system data. So it's the newest version, 3.0, and we've made a lot of efforts to make sure that everyone knows what they need to put in, that they have systems in place, both large and small agencies. And we do make available for the small agencies free this, so they can use our data system to report directly free. So the smaller agencies, that doesn't mean that it won't be difficult for them to make those technological changes. So we will look at a slow phase in time, write the rules, and make sure that everyone is trained at a level so they know that we don't get that garbage in, garbage out type of thing. So we've worked with the trauma registry and done quite a bit there to try and make sure that we have high data quality and that people have enough information. Small hospitals report trauma data too, and they need assistance sometimes. And yeah. So we have that in place for both of these systems and hope to really allow those systems to share, but maybe even beyond that, because the EMS providers, they want more than trauma. They want stroke and STEMI and cardiac arrest and all the other things, and yeah. We want to make that long-term available. This will not require that. We'll enable it, so that's sort of our long-term vision, but our short-term vision is just to make this foundation start and get the EMS pre-hospital data in place.
That's cool. Wonderful. Well, I'll just make sure that you sort of coordinate the amendments and any other questions. And if everyone's in agreement with the amendments, then I, as soon as we get the amendments, we probably will not have another public hearing. We'll just have a work session. Get it out. Okay?
Thank you.
All right. Thank you. With that, I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 52 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 456.
Over. Madam Chair, members of the committee, before you is Senate Bill 456, brought to you by Senator Thompson. The measure establishes the Medical Services Licensure Interstate Compact. The compact would allow EMS providers in Oregon to provide services in states that participate in the multi-state compact. The compact becomes effective when 12 states enact into law the compact and its provisions. As of 2017, 7 states have passed the compact, including neighboring Idaho. There are no amendments, testimonies on all this.
Great. All right. Let me get the right sheet here. Okay. Senator Thompson isn't here. So Donnie Woodward, Randy Lauer, and Ritu Sawhney.
Good afternoon, members of the committee. My name is Donnie Woodyard. I'm with the National Registry of Emergency Medical Technicians based out of Columbus, Ohio. We're the national certification body for emergency medical services personnel that's currently utilized by the state of Oregon. I would just like to provide some overview about the bill that's before you and some background. The purpose of Senate Bill 456 is actually, as you know, to enact REPLICA in Oregon, which is the recognition of EMS Personnel Licensure Interstate Compact. It would provide proper legal protection, the standardization of practices, and accountability for licensed EMS personnel when crossing state lines, but also to ensure that you have an enhanced public protection for people already licensed in your state. So it's not just for crossing lines, it also adds to what you're doing here today. Interstate compacts are formal agreements between two or more states, and they are established to address very specific concerns shared by those states. Currently, Oregon is a member of 30 compacts. In this case, the concerns that Replica seeks to remedy is the inability of individual EMS personnel licensed by one state to practice in other states. And the second part of that is to address a significant gap related to the sharing of license and discipline-related information amongst state regulatory bodies. Before I joined the National Registry, I too was a state regulator. That was my background. And of the things that keep me up at night, that was one of them. I knew I had people that I had licensed, but if action was taken in other states, I had no visibility of that. Replica seeks to address that. In 2012, the National Association of State EMS Officials convened a national advisory panel to explore this compact. From there, a 13-member drafting team, with the assistance by the Council of State Governments, the Center for Interstate Compacts, met and drafted the legislation that's before you in Senate Bill 456. In a general overview of the bill, I'd like to highlight a few things specific to Oregon. If enacted, Oregon would gain new authority over EMS personnel from other compact states when practicing in the state of Oregon. More importantly, you will know who is crossing your border into your state and what background they bring. Under Replica, Oregon maintains all and complete full authority over everyone you license today. That does not change. Your Office of EMS would gain access to a national licensure database. With this database, your EMS office would know if individuals licensed in your state are also licensed in other states. For example, I'm licensed in 5 states. Any individual state I'm licensed in does not know what other states I'm licensed in. Replica would seek to remedy that. Furthermore, you would gain information related to license discipline taken in other states. This is vital for public protection. If another state takes license discipline on an individual currently licensed in Oregon, the only mechanism that we have in place right now is that of a self-disclosure. That does not always work. EMS professionals licensed in Oregon will gain also a privilege to practice in other member states. It's important for me to note that it's a privilege to practice. It's not an immediate license. And we can discuss that a little bit further and answer questions, but there is a fundamental difference. It's a privilege to practice for a purpose, and you must meet certain requirements for that privilege to be utilized and enjoyed. Another example of how Replica will help arises out of the wildland fires that Oregon and many along the West Coast face. While some wildland fire seasons are worse than others, one thing that remains constant, and that is the high demand for qualified EMS personnel to staff fires. Replica will make this process nearly seamless, as it will allow EMS personnel from other compact states that meet the national standard for licensure or certification to practice EMS in support of local-based wildland fire teams. Replica strengthens and complements your existing mechanisms by requiring appropriate EMS medical direction. That's an important component of Replica. It also strengthens and adds new ability for your Office of EMS to collaborate and share information with other state regulators nationwide. That's a vital aspect that is not there today. Replica validates our commitment to veterans. This is another important piece of the bill, and to their spouses by creating an expedited pathway to licensure. As you'll note in the bill, it calls for the states to enact Replica to expedite, not change, but expedite the mechanism for licensure. This is an area that we take seriously, and we do everything possible we can to make the transition from military service to civilian EMS as quick and painless as possible. In closing for my remarks, in order for Oregon and its EMS personnel and patients to recognize the benefits of Replica, the legislator must enact legislation that makes Replica a member state. Oregon already utilizes the National Registry of EMTs for its initial licensure exam, and you already require background checks for EMS personnel. The major hurdles are already done in the state of Oregon. Today, there are seven replica states. We have the eighth state that has already passed it, and it's on the way to the governor's desk. We have another eight states that have it somewhere in the legislative process. I would like to clarify that the bill only requires 10 states, not 12, to actually pass their legislation. It's my hope that Oregon will move this forward, pass replica, and bring in about protection to your providers, lessen the burden felt when managing multiple licenses, and support the advancement of the overall EMS profession. On a closing note, as Idaho, one of your border states, is already a replica state, you would have an immediate benefit along one of your underserved borders in a more remote part of the state. And I'm happy to take any questions, and I also want to yield to the colleagues on the panel.
So let's have the panel first.
Good afternoon, Chair Minas Anderson, Vice Chair Cruz, members of the committee. My name is Randy Lauer. I'm the Regional Director of American Medical Response in Oregon. I'm also the past president of the Oregon State Ambulance Association. I'm here today speaking in support of the bill on behalf of the Oregon State Ambulance Association, which is made up of public and private ambulance service providers that respond to greater than three-fourths of the calls in our state. Ambulances services and the patients they serve near the Oregon border would benefit from this legislation by opening the door for assistance across state lines. For example, if a 911 call for a heart attack occurs in eastern Oregon, a closer Idaho ambulance cannot legally respond without legislation such as this bill. If we have a major incident near the Oregon border where an adjacent state has more resources, such as Longview, Vancouver, Tri-Cities in Walla Walla, Washington, as well as Caldwell, Idaho, they cannot legally help under current statutes. The agreement would ensure patient protection by clarifying medical direction, scope of practice, and powers of investigation if something went wrong. These critical issues are not addressed today, leaving patients, paramedics, and ambulance services at somewhat risk. Idaho, as mentioned, was one of the seven states that have adopted this legislation. If Oregon adopts, communities like Ontario and NISA, near the Idaho border, would benefit right away. Along our Columbia River border with Washington, several communities like Astoria, Rainier, Hood River, Cascade Locks, The Dalles, and Hermiston would all benefit if Washington adopts a similar bill. Another key consideration of the bill, near and dear to my heart as a veteran, is that it supports licensing of military veterans and their spouses who have separated from active duty. So in closing, this bill is good for Oregon, it's good for our neighbors, and most important, it's good for our patients. Thank you for your consideration.
Great.
Chair Monis Anderson, Vice Chair Cruz, and members of the committee, thank you once again for allowing me to testify. My name is Dr. Ritu Sani. I am EMS Medical Director for Washington County EMS and Associate Medical Director for Clackamas County. I speak today on behalf of the National Association of EMS Physicians, both our Oregon chapter and our national. As Donnie outlined the process in which this compact was developed, I was president of the National Association of EMS Physicians at the time that this process was undertaken, and we had a seat at that table as EMS medical directors. And so felt very included in the process. As I stated previously, our focus is on EMS medical direction, and as such, our focus is primarily on patient care and patient outcomes. And we feel that replica would enhance patient outcomes, especially in our border communities. Specifically, we feel that issues of medical oversight and accountability would be much clearer in this situation. For instance, right now, when a cross-border agency comes in, it is really unclear whether that county's EMS medical director is now sort of on the hook for these providers coming in from outside, or if it's actually their medical director who is based, say, in Idaho. You then run into the problem that medical director may not have a license to practice in Oregon, and then it really becomes unclear as to whose medical oversight these EMS practitioners are functioning under. And as a reminder, all EMS providers, practitioners must have medical oversight to provide patient care. We feel that replica would make that very clear, that when crossing a border into a compact state, that your home scope of practice and your home protocols are what you function under, and as such, I wouldn't have to worry about the liability if I were a medical director in a border county of somebody else coming in. We also feel that as medical directors, we want to have authority and oversight over our teams, and this allows us to make sure that when they're crossing a border, that they maintain that oversight. And then finally, I just want to mention we have a fairly robust air ambulance system in this state, and sort of one of my colleagues who is an air medical director for LifeLight has to have licenses in Washington, Oregon, Idaho, California, and Nevada because their air ambulance may pass into those states, even though he is based here in Oregon, and the air ambulance in question that he's medical director over is based in Oregon. And so this would definitely reduce the burden of having to have multiple licenses if the air ambulance moves into another state. Or, I'm sorry, responds into another state.
Responds in another state, yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah, if just for clarification also, I know that the model legislation as introduced, we typically encourage that compacts do not have substantive changes to it. But I do want to extend that should your committee encounter any concerns along the way, we stand ready to help. We also have part of our national drafting team, some compact lawyers who have assisted that are willing to help provide advice should you see some amendments that need to be entertained for this to pass in Oregon. It's important for us that Oregon takes this forward, and we would not want to see something stand in the way of that.
Thank you. Are there questions now for this panel? None? Okay. Thank you. And I'm sorry that Senator Thompson isn't here because I have a constituent that lives in Cascade Locks, and then Senator Thompson actually represents Cascade Locks. Oh, there's Senator Thompson. Yes, he did. Come on up. I was just explaining that my constituent, Paul Cook, works for Cascade Locks, and
he's very persistent.
He is very persistent. There is a problem in Cascade Locks, so that's where the problem is, committee. Senator Thompson.
Yeah, Senator Thompson, District 26. Thank you, Chair, Co-Chair, and Committee. Senator Mona Sanderson mentioned Paul Cook. He was at the time, probably when he first talked to me about this, well, he was the interim city manager of Cascade Locks. He's now the manager of the Port of Cascade Locks. And the issues down there, you know, Cascade Locks is right on the freeway, and they have accidents, and, you know, they have volunteers. Like a lot of small communities, they have a volunteer fire department. I think maybe they have one paid chief down there part-time or off and on. So it's very hard to for a small city to man a paid fire department and have all the EMS things, too. So what happens with them is if they get an accident out on the freeway, and then, I mean, that takes all their resources. And they go clear almost down to Corbett a lot of times on the it would be the westbound lanes to cover a lot of that area for a lot of different people. So that puts them kind of stranded. And the way the laws are right now, they're not able to if they have a heart attack victim in downtown while they're out on the freeway, Stevenson's right across the river, right across the bridge. They're not allowed to come over because of every state has different their requirements are a little bit different to be an EMT in Washington, to be an EMT in Oregon, so they don't fit those requirements, so they can't do it unless they get the cross-border agreements, and sometimes those are cumbersome and they don't work. And basically it's for Cascade Locks, it's just a matter of they don't have the dollars to do it. It's just the way it is in small town USA. But I just want to write a few things. This bill was first brought to me, my attention, by the city of Cascade Locks and Paul Cook. They're always struggling and paying extra when it comes to emergency personnel and cannot access help from just across the river in Stevenson, like I said. It's clear that certain barriers exist to prevent EMS service in border towns throughout Oregon, and some should be addressed. As a remedy, if you remember him, he was Darren Nichols. He was at one time he was the Columbia Gorge Commission agency head. He pointed us to this group, the National Conference of State Legislators Language Compact for the EM Services, which you have heard previously. I sponsored this bill in the last short session, but, you know, as short sessions go, it was just kind of a time to bring the idea up to the good chair, and they heard it, and then we've been working on this concept throughout the summertime, and now we're finally here having a hearing. I've been very grateful to Nanheim for helping keep this bill on everyone's mind since then. She's done a great job, and I thank her for that. And ultimately, I'm happy with all the discussions we've had. With this bill, we've got introduced to Carl Koenig with the Firefighters Council, and he's been very, very helpful paving the way and navigating Cascade Locks through their issues. And I just want to thank Carl. He's got some great ideas, and I think we'll get there with your help and everybody's help. So I want to thank the committee for hearing the bill. Thank you very much.
Great. Thank you, Senator Thompson. Yeah. Questions for Senator Thompson?
Just,
yeah.
Just one. Idaho is a compact state. Washington is not. Is that correct?
I believe that's true. Yeah, Idaho's the only one.
I'm trying to figure out how this solves the problem for Cascade Locks.
Well, I don't know if this does, but I think you got to start somewhere. I mean, we'd go to them next. Yeah.
Follow up to that, Madam Chair.
So, like most interstate compacts, it takes 14 states to ratify. 14?
10.
10 states to ratify. There are 7 already. Does anybody know if Washington's actually got this under consideration?
You must come forward.
Sorry. Once this question, you asked a good question, Senator Cruz, and I just want to clarify, because if they're considering it too, that.
Sure. I'm currently not tracking a piece of legislation in Washington State. There have been conversations there, and certainly if Idaho and Oregon were part of it, it would seem like that would be a very favorable condition.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. And with
thank you.
That, Carly Hahn, and then Charles fuzzy. Savoy and Carl Koenig.
Pretty fuzzy on when
is Carly?
No.
Carly Hahn, no. Did she leave?
Okay.
Can I flip for?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Excuse me. You want to go? You ready?
I can go.
All right.
Well, I'm not. I will. Good afternoon, Madam Chair, Vice Chair Cruz, Committee. My name is Charles Savoy. I'm the an assistant to Dave Tolley, who's the labor representative for the paramedics and EMTs that work for AMR in Portland and, well, Multnomah and Clackamas counties. Here today representing the union and the EMS professionals that are our members that we represent. We have several concerns with the replica bill that are largely due to certain parts of it that seem to us to be overly broad, vague, or opening cans of worms that we don't believe we should be opening. At the beginning of the compact, in the statement of purpose, it says that my right click is broken. Sorry about that. It says that this emergency medical services personnel licensure interstate compact facilitates day-to-day movement of EMS personnel across state boundaries in the performance of their EMS duties as assigned by an appropriate authority that authorizes state EMS offices to afford immediate, and this is where we all of a sudden run into a red flag, that provides immediate legal recognition
to EMS personnel licensed in a member state. To us, that's a pretty broad statement that allow or more or less mandates that if Oregon were to become part of this compact, that persons coming from another EMS providers who are licensed in another compact state upon entering Oregon and providing care in Oregon, which is where it moves on to, would immediately be recognized as being allowed to practice in the state. There's no restriction on how long or under what conditions that applies. So basically, with that broad wording, what you have is a situation where if someone, say, were to come from Idaho or a different compact state, move to Oregon, thereby entering the state, and decide they want to go to work for American Medical Response in Portland, if they're licensed in their home state, that they previously was their home state, they would then be automatically licensed or allowed to practice as an employee of American Medical Response in Portland. We absolutely could not tolerate that kind of situation. First off, it runs contrary to everything the state of Oregon has done as far as licensure in the past. And secondly, it would severely hamper the ability of our members to negotiate with the company. It would weaken our bargaining position. Then there's the professional aspect of it, because the persons that we represent are EMS professionals, and they're concerned that aspects of this legislation take us down a path that erodes the strides that Oregon has made in the past for elevating EMS profession into a more professional status, from the cowboy status that everybody perceived, or the ambulance driver perception that a lot of people have. And to us, does this by stating that if a person is in one of the compact states and licensed in the compact state and is then immediately recognized in Oregon, they don't have to meet the same requirements for that a person who is licensed in the state of Oregon has to meet. They have to meet an inferior standard. That is unacceptable to us. We believe that anybody who works in the state as an EMS professional or as an EMS provider needs to meet the same requirements as a person who is licensed in the state. The current compact basically requires that you're 18, licensed in another state, have met the national registry requirements for training and education, and that's pretty much the end of the requirement. There's no requirement that you've practiced for 3 years out of the last five at the national registry level. So we have these concerns, and we hope that they can be addressed and that amendments either to the compact itself or to the existing statutes within Oregon are enacted simultaneously if you decide to go forward and join the compact. But unless we have that assurance, we're going to have to oppose it.
Thank you. Questions for him? Carl.
Madam Chair, Monis Anderson, and Vice Chair Cruz, committee members. For the record, I'm Carl Koenig, Legislative Director for the Oregon State Firefighters Council, representing the 3,200 career firefighters, EMTs, and paramedics throughout Oregon. We're here today in opposition of Senate Bill 456, also known as Replica. As a paramedic, both on the streets and in the office, I have a broad base of experience within our Oregon EMS system. Oregon is a mature, progressive system made up of dedicated individuals, both on the street and administratively. Senate Bill 456 purports to fix a problem that Oregon does not have. At its inception, Replica's goal was admirable. During catastrophic emergency situations, it will allow the out-of-state paramedics and EMTs to legally operate in situations requiring less than a proclamation of the governor. My organization, the International Association of Firefighters, was part of that discussion. When that transferred over to the day-to-day operations focus of ambulance and medic unit utilization, the IFF and our organization politely bowed out. Replica is not for Oregon, and here's why we think so. Just as one example, within 5 years, stated in Replica, background checks will be compulsory for all members of the compact. Oregon EMS already requires extensive background checks to ensure the public safety. 5 years is a long time without background checks if this bill becomes law, meaning if you're registered in another state, their background check stuff, and if they don't do them today, they don't have to do them for 5 years, reportedly. During unprecedented pressure on local and state budgets, joining this compact comes with an unknown financial liabilities Oregon and its paramedics cannot afford. Subrogating our authority to yet-to-be-developed commission puts Oregon firefighters and EMTs in the impossible situation of serving another regulatory agency without the benefit of representation in the event of a disagreement. Oregon's firefighters and EMTs lose. A quasi-governmental organization with subpoena powers, taxing authority, ambiguous public meeting requirements, along with a proposed single representative on the Compact Commission, is nothing this state or our paramedics need. Oregon is a collective bargaining state. Your firefighters and paramedics currently have collaborative processes to voice our concern. Replica does not. No one, not one mention of labor or labor organizations or representatives in Replica. Oregon's EMTs and paramedics deserve a continued voice in our profession. We're concerned with nebulous terms such as the unidentified appropriate authority and the granting of a higher power to facilitate the day-to-day operations of providers in Oregon. On the first page is the statement, enhances the state's ability to protect the public's health and safety. I've already stated having 5 years to get a background check program going is hardly that. We're not in need of a commission located in another state determining our level of public safety in throughout Oregon. Oregon AHA EMS administratively oversees regulatory matters regarding 100% of the state's EMTs and paramedics. Administrative oversight by a commission in another state is problematic. Oregon will only have one representative, and therefore the Oregon EMS professionals are potentially represented by only one person of a currently unnamed affiliation, meaning we don't know who this person is from Oregon that's going to represent us. But having one in a state where we have many now is unacceptable. The compact states that a public hearing regarding the rule adoption will occur only if 25 people or a governmental subdivision requests it. This model will be funded with public dollars and must be open without needing to request it. Oregon cannot be part of any compact that gives its right of transparency and public meeting laws away. Other areas of concern that aren't addressed in Replica are the communications interoperability, vehicle licensing for public agencies across state lines, or the ability to assure proper quality control. State agencies going into other states to ensure compliance with compact rules and regulations? These are unreasonable demands of Oregon and the Oregon Health Authority to ensure compliance. Until Minnesota's signing on to Replica, and it's in process, only New Hampshire was a collective bargaining state. The remaining states on board with Replica are right-to-work states. That is not Oregon. This compact brings no voice or workplace protections for the EMTs and paramedics taking care of our citizens and visitors to Oregon. The veterans provision is only if they are NREMT, National Registry EMT certifying organizations. Not all branches of the military are. We have provisions within our current statutes that allow for that. It also should be noted that other allied health professionals in Oregon refuted the idea of similar bills. Physicians, nurses, physical therapists have all successfully opposed similar bills. Are Oregon's EMTs and paramedics any different? No improvement in the public's trust or safety, the loss of state control, no transparency of mission, non-existent checks and balances, approving an out-of-state commission with taxing authority? That doesn't sound like Oregon to me. Replica clearly removes our voice at the table. On a positive note, Senate Bill 456 did bring the care of this bill, Senator Thompson, and our organization together to solve a problem. And we have worked diligently with the OHA in bringing those people, Hood River County, Cascade Locks, elected leadership together to try and solve specifically their problem. This bill does not fix Washington at all. It's not that Washington has no interest in copying Oregon. I think there might be a bridge not named for that. Replica does not solve the state-to-state issue I just talked about. EMS Compact is not made for Oregon. Your firefighters asked the committee to keep Oregon's EMTs and paramedics whole. Out-of-state control, unpredictable fees or assessments, quasi-government oversight, single-party representation, and no proposed transparency. In conclusion, we'd like to thank the Healthcare Committee for our opportunity to talk on this matter. I'll be more than willing to answer any questions.
Okay, questions. Okay, I would like, I've already talked to Senator Thompson and would like you to continue working with him because we do have a problem and as in Cascade Locks. That's why it came here. So let us just give this bill some more time before we do anything, and I am looking forward to hearing back from you.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
And does anyone else want to make any comments after they've heard the opposition, those that are for? Okay. All right. Yes. Oh, yes. All right. Now, I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 456 and open a work session on introduction of committee bill measures.
Madam Chair, I move that the following LCs be introduced as committee bill. I did plural. I should have done singular. My fault. LC 2226 dated 11-8-16.
Okay, Vice Chair Cruz moves that the following LC be introduced as a committee bill, LC 2226, dated 11-8-16. Is there any discussion? Is there any opposition? So ordered. I will close the work session on introduction of committee measures. If there's no further issues to discuss, we're adjourned.